accession number 27083, reel 48.
So Henry, you said that being vice chief of the defence staff in those days was a bit of a non-job.
Yes, that is true. It was so regarded. I can't think of anybody who of any service who had been vice chief of defence and had gone on to the top. They might have gone on to better things, like a commander in chief somewhere, depending on the service. But they had not gone to the top. So. The way things were looming, I reckoned that I would not go to the top. But first things first, I had this super C job. And I said that it was a prime job because there were three C jobs, if you discount the Commander-in-Chief Fleet, who of necessity, because he was a major NATO commander as CNC Channel, and we'll come to that later, the three real sea jobs were flag officer first flotilla, flag officer second flotilla, and flag officer carriers and amphibious ships, who commanded, as the name implies. It so happened, and it had become this way by accident rather than design, that the first flotilla was quite a bit bigger than the second flotilla. This was just because of different classes of ships and the way the fleet was organized and so forth. It was entirely fortuitous, but it happened to go that way, which is why I say that FOF 1 was really a pretty prime job. And to describe it briefly, you had a small shore headquarters come flat in Portsmouth Dockyard, but you spent virtually the whole of your life at sea. You had a small staff. It consisted of, you had a secretary, you had a flag lieutenant who was the staff communications officer. You had a staff gunnery officer, you had a staff torpedo anti-submarine officer. And that was about it. For technical staff, you relied on the senior technical officer, either mechanical or electrical engineering, in your flagship at the time, because you were always at sea, and so on. And I had a very good staff. I joined the cruiser Blake as my first flagship. I joined her in Portsmouth. I suppose I had a quarter of an hour or so with my predecessor, who I knew well and liked and respected, and he went on to be naval secretary. I met my small staff. We had lunch together. A couple of them, the chief of staff, who was a commander, and the others were lieutenant commanders on the whole, and I then got into a car directly after lunch, and we drove down to Portland, where we embarked in the guided missile destroyer Devonshire, who didn't even belong to my flotilla, commanded by Peter Buchanan, who I'd known. He'd been the staff officer operations when I'd been chief staff officer plans and ops out in Singapore, with a charming executive officer called Jonathan Todd, who is now the chairman of the Sea Cadet Association, and so forth. And I'd never served in a guided missile destroyer before, so that was new to me. And in those ships, you had a lift, which took you from the compass platform to the ops room, which was down in the bowels of the ship, and vice versa. A rather curious arrangement, I thought, because if you had if you hit a mine or were hit by a torpedo, and the lift got distorted, and high talent was inside the lift, then it was difficult to extract them. But so that's how it was. They were unusual ships. The day cabin for the commanding officer, or the admiral if embarked, was of a size. It was about the size of this room. It was spacious. And then you had a small sleeping cabin and a bathroom, and that was that.
I must say that the size of this room would be 20 square, 25 square.
That sort of thing, actually.
Yes.
Yeah. And immediately forward was one of two 4-5 turrets, one of which was gradually replaced by Sea Slug. No, I lied. Sea Slug was aft, that's right. You could have had a missile launcher instead of that turret, and you didn't. And if you hadn't had such a large cabin, you could certainly have gone. That could have acted as a missile magazine, and they would then have been very powerful ships. They were underarmed, but there they were. Anyway, we went down to Portland, and an hour or so later, we sailed. We went round the corner and up through the Irish Sea, up to Scottish waters, to do a national exercise, which was a mixture of anti-air and anti-submarine, not much in the way of surface. And bear in mind, I'd now spent 3 years on shore, and I had to get back to life at sea, and so I pushed myself, I hoped. I needed to test myself again as to my capacity for doing without sleep when it was necessary, and so forth. And I drove my small staff accordingly. Not sure if they terribly like that, but so. And I got away with it, and I just managed to last the exercise out, and we arrived at Recife, and I suppose we must have got there on a Friday afternoon, that sort of thing, and I'd about had it by then. I was I'd reached my limit. And I was met by my wife, who had come up, and we went to a tiny little pub on the east coast of Scotland for the weekend, because I wasn't wanted on board, and the staff would work out things to display during the wash-up, which was going to occur on the Monday after the exercise. And we fished hard all weekend. And I remember we had a young gilly who must have been all of 14 years old. Delightful lad, and a very good gilly, but there were no fish. And I slept the whole way up. My wife drove, and I just slept. And that was that. Well, we had the usual wash-up. Where do I go now?
The wash-up is the debrief on the...
That's the debrief on the exercise, yes.
On the exercise.
And this was, of course, at Recife on the east coast. And all in all, I then left the ship. And interestingly, and I was very tired, very tired. And I suppose if you're very tired, you become more rather than less emotional. But it was of interest that I'd only been on board 10 days, fortnight at the outside, probably only 10 days. And I felt I knew that ship. I knew a lot of people in her. And I had an affinity with that ship. And she wasn't even in my flotilla. And whenever I came across her, which wasn't very often, in later months, we always had a slight exchange. And I think it was mutual somehow. So, and she was a good ship. And I felt very sad to leave her. I, in fact, had 8 different flagships in my first 2 months as Fourth One. And this meant packing everything up and moving. And you took a couple of stewards with you and a couple of the staff, and that was that. But that's what you were hired to do, and that was fun. Though, of the various flagships throughout my time, Blake predominated, and that was fine. In Blake, as I think I may have mentioned earlier, she was a curious hotchpotch. After turrets had been removed and the flight deck had been substituted, she carried 4 Sea King big anti-submarine helicopters. She had elderly machinery, elderly everything really, except for the 6-inch and the 3-inch armament, which was pretty small, very automatic. The 6-inch almost invariably jammed after about 6 rounds, so it wasn't very effective, and so on. But there she was, she existed, and so on. She had been subjected to stop-go in terms of construction, and later on in terms of conversion, and so on. She was an old ship when she first entered service, and so was much of the machinery. And the boys below, the engineers, had a pretty rough time. It was old technology. It was manpower, highly manpower intensive, and conditions were not very good for hot climates and so on. But there she was. She was a hull. She was 10,000 tons. She had reasonable communications. A not very up-to-date ops room, but up-to-date enough. And that was it. It was the practice of the ship, when at sea, anyone at sea, to produce a sort of magazine on a daily basis. It was a 2, at the most, 3 page thing that was run off, and it was known as the Oily Rag. It was produced by a leading marine engineering mechanic in the engineer's office, who had, it was rather like Private Eye. I was never a member of Private Eye, but there were several eyes scattered about the place, I think, that contributed to it. And so it was with the Oily Rag. They had various sources of information, and they were quite widespread throughout the ship. And they were all fed in centrally at sea to the engineer's office, where the editor, this leading stoker, produced a hilarious answer.
But this was all fictitious information?
All
fictitious, or?
Oh, no. It was real. Absolutely real. And so were the people. But the people, depending on who they were, but once you got to a certain level, like the commander, the captain, and certainly the admiral, we were depicted as cockroaches. And on the wings, the transparent wings of the cockroach, no names are mentioned, but on the transparent wings were the badges of rank.
Yes, the
insignia. And so it was absolutely clear, even to the thickest, precisely who the cockroaches were. And one would say, you know, say Fred, spelled P-H-R-E, et cetera, et cetera. And it was a hoot. And it kept the ship to a very high state of morale. It was marvellous. And this went on, the whole commission. I got a few things somewhere. No, I think they're next door in my old house now. I had a very good relationship with the flag captain, a man called Peter Herbert. He was a submariner. He eventually became flag officer submarines and ended up as a full admiral in charge of logistics and stuff in the Minister of Defence. A very good man indeed. She was a very good ship. And despite the obsoleteness rather than obsolescence and the manpower intensity of virtually everything she touched, people took, at all levels, took pride in somehow making this elderly stuff work. And they did, too. They worked very hard, long hours, under very poor conditions, and took great pride in it. We did a major exercise shortly afterwards, after I got back to Blake. I think it was a national one, but I can't quite remember. It doesn't matter. And we sailed from Portsmouth to join the exercise, and we were going to go west of Land's End, and I think we were going to go west of Ireland too, and up, and eventually end up at Rosyth again. And the Royal Yacht Britannia was going to act as a Russian spy ship, an AGI, during this. And the flag officer of Royal Yachts at the time had been a member of my term at Dartmouth, and he was, by way of being a friend, called Hugh Jen, and he's dead now, poor chap. And I thought what fun it would be if I got him on board Blake, and I would send a helicopter over to pick him up. But once I'd got him, I'd keep him. And that would cook his goose. But he knew me a bit too, and he suspected I might do something, and he was prepared to leave, and so that didn't come off. And then one evening, the exercise didn't really start until we got west of Land's End. And we were crossing Lyme Bay, south of England. And I was in the staff office with my team, and we had a full team there because she had the accommodation to have us all. And it was about 9 o'clock at night, and the bridge messenger came down and said that the officer of the watch had just seen a green grenade on the starboard bow. And a green grenade is the submarine signal at the moment that it would, in an exercise, but it would, for real, have fired its torpedo. Well, the exercise hadn't started. And so we looked at each other and said, the exercise hadn't started, and sent him back to the bridge. And then we got a second message. I think the signalman came down or something. That another green grenade had been sighted. By this time, we were getting a bit irritated and saying, blah, blah, blah. And then the officer of the watch sent the midshipman of the watch down. And that was the third time. And I suddenly thought, oh, come on, we're being stuffy about this. And here are we, acting independently. We're about to go into a war situation. That's not unrealistic because, there might have been an ultimatum, but it hasn't expired yet. And so I gave instructions for the source of this green flare. I think it was a fisherman's flare, probably. that a signal should be dispatched to it saying, one more and I will take you out. Well, that meant, of course, nothing to a fisherman, but I wanted to have the signal on the record. And I then made a flash, which is an emergency signal, to the fleet headquarters at Northwood, and said what had happened and what I had threatened. And we awaited events. And sadly, Northwood didn't play ball. I thought it was a jolly good initiative test to sharpen people up. And back came a stuffy signal saying that the exercise hadn't yet started. And so I was livid.
I can imagine.
But it was it was not at all unrealistic. And the other guy, who might know something that we didn't, and he would have taken us out.
Yes. It'd
been the end of my flag trip.
Yes.
And me.
Yes.
But he didn't go down terribly well. Then there was a senior engineer, a splendid man, used to draw excellent, various sort of, not very many lines in them, cartoons. And he would again take off anybody. And in particular, he would take off myself and the flag captain and the other ships and so forth. And I was depicted as a master of foxhounds, and the flag captain was depicted as the whipper-in. And the other ships in company, because we were now about to go on a deployment, the other ships were depicted as hounds. So when anything happened to one of the other ships, like there was a serious fire in one of them, you could see this unfortunate hound with a blackened face and its tail between its legs and that sort of thing, and everybody knew exactly. Again, it was a thing that kept the morale, kept the spirits very high. Well, we sailed on a deployment which would take us around the Cape, out to the Far East, and back again. 9 months door to door. And en route, we would pass the second flotilla, or a group from them, not all of them, but with their flag officer, who was a man called Dick Clayton, who was a personal friend, and that was fine. And somewhere off the Azores, there was a great cry that we had to update a particular naval. It's on answer phone.
Okay. So we just need to finish.
That's good.
That's okay.
They wanted to update, to have an updated recruiting film. I hadn't done this sort of trick before, but what they wanted was a lot of ships passing very close to each other, looking frightfully impressive, and that's rather like the rather like the introduction to any naval film when the news bulletin, when you would see battleships in close order coming straight towards them, that sort of thing. And so the two flotillas met up, and I was the overall boss. I think by then I'd got my third star, and I was a vice admiral. And we spent something like 8 hours towing and froing, gridiron movements and the lot.
What is a gridiron movement?
It's when you have a group of ships, two groups of ships, and they pass side to side in opposite directions at high speed. And it's quite impressive. When it actually comes out in photographic form, of course, you can't get all the ships in unless it's an aerial shot. And even so, it looks dead easy, but it isn't.
Yes.
Now we had Blake, we had a tanker, a cruiser, a tanker, we had a squadron of frigates, and our main armament, as it were, our main weapon, was Warspite, a nuclear submarine. She was late. She had some defect or other, and she suddenly surfaced in the middle of our doing our maneuvers and so forth. So that added a bit of excitement and so on. It was very boring. It wasn't a very satisfactory result, quite honestly, and I think it was a complete waste of time. But there it was. We took over a South African frigate which had come up from Simonstown with the 2nd Flotilla. And she then transferred to my lot, and we took her back down to South Africa. This was very good stuff. They were a good crowd. They had a good commanding officer. That's really all I got to say about it. I'll touch again in a moment. And we arrived off the Cape, and the frigates went into Simonstown, the Astral Naval Base there, and we went into Cape Town proper. And going in, there we were on an operational visit to a friendly foreign country. And so I fired a salute, 21 guns, national salute. This was in, I suppose, October, October 74. The government back home in UK had just changed. Wilson had taken over as Prime Minister. The cabinet had been sorted. It was the back end of the summer recess and so forth, and it was all pretty dead. And it was a time when there was no national news because the internal political scene had stabilized, more or less, and there was no foreign excitement at the time. And some left winger got up in the house said, what right had this dreadful fellow, Flag Officer First Flotilla, to fire a 21-gun salute to that horrible country, repressive country, South Africa? And what were they doing to the blacks and all that sort of thing? And the media, who had nothing better to do, caught on to it. And all hell was let loose. It really was. To the extent that, although I only discovered this later, one day my wife, next door of course then, she'd come in at about 1 o'clock, having been dunging the roses, and was covered in. And she saw a fellow hanging around the back door, which is the one we normally use because of access to the garden. And thinking that it was the laundryman come to drop his box of goodies, said, that's all right, I'll be with you in a moment. I've got a check ready inside, and went in. And when she came out again, she discovered this was not the laundryman at all. It was from the Daily Express. And there was a man and his winger, and they really had at her, and said, you know, what did I think of this fellow leech, her husband, banging off his guns in salute to a horrible country like South Africa? And she, of course, was entirely unbriefed about this, didn't know that I'd done this even. But she knew enough about the Navy, and her father was a was a sailor too, as I've told you earlier. And she knew enough about it to realize that they were making a mountain out of nothing at all. And so she gave them as good as she got. But they persisted, and they said, but he understood that there was a photograph of my sailors splashing around with South African girls, and Lord knows what I was up to, and all that sort of thing. And this got under her skin, and she said, when were you last away from your wife and family for a whole 3 weeks without a means of communicating? And that set them back a bit, and so forth. And so it went on and on. And give them their due, it was very accurate reporting. And they produced all this in next day's issue, which caused the CNC, who by then was Terry Lewin, he'd moved up one too, to telephone her, to give her support, and so forth. And there we were. Well, as soon as we got to Cape Town, the first thing I did was, had to do, was to hold a press conference. And one of the earlier questions they asked me was, it was a statement rather than a question, and they put it in that well-known way. We understand that one of our South African frigates has been in company with your squadron the whole way south.